It was the middle of the day, not late at night, not the dark early morning hours when danger feels more expected. Late Saturday morning, the kind of time when children are awake, when neighbors are moving through their routines, when nothing about the hour suggests violence. Inside an apartment in Orlando, Florida, three children were home, and then gunfire. Not distant, not outside. Inside the walls of a place meant to be safe. Police would arrive, paramedics would follow. Children would be carried out of the apartment unharmed. And in a bedroom down the hall, a woman lay unresponsive, shot multiple times. By the time deputies reached her, there was nothing they could do. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Her name was Portia Streeter. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hey there. Some cases take time to feel off or unsettled. This one doesn't. Because from the start, the setting and the timing make certain explanations harder to accept. This didn't happen in the cloak of night, when routines blur and witnesses sleep. It happened on a Saturday morning, inside an apartment, with children awake and families nearby. That matters. Not because it tells us what happened, but because it limits what could have happened without being noticed. And yet, what followed depended on the idea that people wouldn't notice, that they would stay quiet, that time wouldn't interfere, and that those inside the home wouldn't challenge the story being told. What happened inside that apartment was not immediately clear, but it happened in a space where sound carries through shared walls and where time leaves a record. It leaves impressions. It leaves memories. It leaves witnesses, often unsuspecting ones. And eventually, it leaves questions that words alone can't answer. That's the tension at the heart of this case. All right, let's go back to where it all began. It was 11:50 a.m. on a mild Saturday morning when the 911 call came in. Deputies were dispatched to a reported shooting on the 7300th block of Woodhill Park Drive in Orlando, Florida. When officers arrived and entered the apartment, the first thing they saw was a man sitting on the floor. He had been shot in the arm. His name was Sean Range. Inside the apartment were three children, a 10-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 1-year-old. None of them had been injured in the shooting. Deputies moved quickly, removing all three children from the home before continuing their assessment of the scene. As that was happening, officers asked Sean what had occurred. He told them he had come by to check on his family when an armed man, dressed in black and wearing a mask, followed him inside. According to Sean, the intruder demanded money. He said the man kicked in the bedroom door and struck his 10-year-old son. Portia had been in bed with her children before the commotion and tried to call for help. He said she was shot repeatedly in her legs and arms. Sean told officers his own injury happened as he tried to shield the children while the gunman opened fire and then ran from the apartment. When officers asked if Portia was all right, Sean told them yes. He said he had just spoken to her right before dialing 911. He directed deputies down the hallway toward the bedroom. As they approached, officers noticed the master bedroom door was damaged. It appeared to have been kicked in, just as Sean had described. But inside, the scene shifted. Portia was found on the floor, unresponsive. She had suffered multiple gunshot wounds. There was no pulse. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Portia Nikita Streeter was 30 years old. She was a mother of three, young, vibrant, and deeply invested in her children's lives. Her days were full in the way many working mothers know well: school routines, childcare, and long hours spent building something of her own. Portia was a talented hairstylist and makeup artist, running a small business out of her apartment. It wasn't just work, it was pride. Clients came to her not only for her skill, but for the way she made people feel when they left her chair. She was creative, independent, focused on providing for her children in a way that allowed her to stay close to them. Portia had known Sean since high school. Their relationship spanned years, and together they shared all three of their children. By January 2024, they were no longer living together, but they remained connected, working together to co-parent, keeping routines stable for the kids. Sean would stay overnight from time to time, helping with the children, moving in and out of the apartment in a way that felt familiar. To the outside world, it looked like cooperation, like stability, like a family still finding its footing. And that's what makes what happened next so difficult to reconcile. Because the apartment where Portia built her business, where her children slept, where she was known and trusted, is the same place deputies would soon walk through, retracing steps, measuring distances, and trying to understand how a space filled with routine and care became the setting for something so final. As the scene was secured, the response expanded. Homicide detectives arrived, along with the medical examiner's office. The apartment was no longer just a place of emergency. It was now a place of investigation. Although Sean had been shot, he was stable, and detectives continued to speak with him. They asked if he knew who the shooter was. Sean told them he did not. He said he didn't know the man and had never seen him before. He repeated that he had stopped by the apartment to check on his family when someone attacked him from behind. According to Sean, the intruder entered the home, opened fire, and then ran. He told investigators the man took $2,000 in cash and three cell phones. He said Portia reached for her phone to call for help and was shot multiple times. After the shooter fled, Sean said he waited and then chased after him. He claimed he caught up to the man and was able to wrestle away the stolen phones. Then he returned to the apartment. He told detectives that he initially planned to go to neighbors for help. He said his son begged him not to leave, that he stayed behind, tending to Portia, urging her to keep fighting. Then, he said, he went to nearby apartments asking them to call 911. Detectives documented his account. They wrote it down, line by line, as it was given. And once his statement was taken, Sean was transported to a hospital for treatment of the gunshot wound to his arm. He was listed in stable condition and expected to recover. By then, the apartment had gone quiet. The children were gone. The medics were finished. And what remained were the details that would follow this case forward. As crime scene detectives documented the apartment, other officers began canvassing the neighborhood. Neighbors were shaken. Several told officers that Sean had come to their doors asking them to call 911. Officers asked residents if they had seen or heard anything, and if they had security cameras. Some neighbors reported hearing gunshots around 9:30 a.m. that day. Others said they hadn't seen anyone fleeing the area. Investigators collected what footage they could and continued building the timeline. In the days and weeks that followed, detectives reached out to friends and family to better understand Portia's personal connections. More specifically, her relationship with Sean. Friends confirmed that the two had known each other since high school and shared all three children together. But they also described a relationship that was far from stable. Several told investigators the relationship was toxic. They said Portia lived alone, but that Sean stayed overnight occasionally. And then came details investigators hadn't been told at the scene. Friends reported a history of domestic violence and infidelity, incidents that had never been formally reported. One friend told police that Sean had physically assaulted Portia just days before the shooting. Others corroborated that account, sharing photographs of injuries Portia had sent them. As investigators worked through the footage, they continued building the timeline another way, through phone records. Text messages revealed that Sean and Portia had been engaged in what investigators described as a very intense argument around the time of her death. The messages showed rising tension. Detectives uncovered a brewing custody dispute, along with indications that Sean had recently learned Portia was hiding money from him, including a $20,000 loan she had taken out without his knowledge. Investigators also noted messages suggesting he was upset about her seeing another man, and one text in which Portia called him a sissy. In those same exchanges, Portia demanded that Sean return the key to her apartment. The messages referenced custody repeatedly. Sean claimed Portia was supposed to give him full custody of the children. But the final texts told a different story. She wasn't going to do that. As those details came together, detectives began narrowing their focus, not only because of the history that was emerging, but because as they continued reconstructing the timeline and the evidence at the scene, parts of Sean's account no longer aligned. Still, they didn't have enough. Not yet. There was no evidence he had done anything. So, there was no arrest. But what they did have placed Sean squarely in the role of person of interest. So investigators turned back to the footage, examining every camera, every angle, every minute they could account for. Because somewhere inside that footage, they believed the truth was still waiting. Investigators started with the cameras closest to the scene. They located a working surveillance camera positioned near the front door and pulled the footage. But something was wrong. The camera that should have captured the intrusion had no record of it. That window of time was gone. But cameras elsewhere in the apartment complex did. And what they captured was unexpected. Footage showed Sean driving near Portia's apartment on the morning of the murder. He wasn't alone. Another man was with him. Other surveillance video appeared to show a man fleeing the scene. He was wearing a distinct, brightly colored Ferrari jacket. Investigators took a closer look. When investigators questioned Sean, he described the shooter as wearing black clothing and a black mask. But when they spoke with Sean's 10-year-old son, a different picture emerged. They asked the child to describe the shooter. What the child described matched what investigators had seen on video. The clothing was the same. It was a match. At that point, the scene no longer resembled the spontaneous home invasion Sean had described, especially after investigators noticed something else. Before the shooting, Sean and the other man were seen on camera, standing behind Portia's apartment at the same time, not running, not fleeing, just there. Together. And with that, the timeline investigators were building began to point somewhere very different than where it had started. Not to an unknown intruder, but to Sean and the man seen with him on surveillance. Investigators were able to trace that second man back to a residence less than a mile from the apartment. They identified him as Benjamin Garman. By then, detectives had more than just footage. They had motive, they had opportunity, and they had a version of events that no longer lined up. Still, it wouldn't move quickly, because this was no longer about what happened in a moment. It was about taking months to carefully pick apart a story that had been told once and accepted early. The most damning part of the story wasn't the phone records, it wasn't the text messages, and it wasn't even the surveillance footage. It was what officers noticed that very first night. When deputies asked Sean about Portia's condition, He told them she was all right. He said he had just spoken to her before calling 911. But when the medical examiner arrived at the apartment, that account no longer held. The examiner observed dry blood around Portia's wounds and early signs of decomposition. Based on those findings, they determined Portia had been dead for at least 2 hours before the 911 call was ever made. That timeline placed the shooting around 9:30 a.m., the same time neighbors reported hearing gunshots inside the complex, not 11:50 a.m. when the 911 call was made. Investigators now believed Portia had been shot long before Sean called for help. They also began questioning Sean's account of what happened afterward. He told officers that once the shooter fled, he ran after him, unarmed. Not to get help, not to call for medical assistance for Portia, but to chase the man who had just shot them. That detail didn't make sense to investigators. Neither did the delay. Although Sean did go to neighbors asking them to call 911, it wasn't immediately. It was nearly 2 hours later, enough time for blood to dry and for the body to begin decomposing. Investigators also questioned the gunfire itself. Portia had been shot multiple times, accurately and fatally. Sean, by contrast, had sustained a single gunshot wound to the arm. Detectives questioned how a supposed home invader could be so precise with one victim and so restrained with another. They believed the injury to Sean was meant to make the story more believable. By this point, detectives believed the shooting inside the apartment was not the final act, but part of a staged one. They theorized that Sean had left the apartment with Portia already dead or dying, her children still inside, and later returned with the man, who then shot Sean in the arm to make the home invasion story more believable. Investigators believed that man was Benjamin Garman. Other evidence supported that theory. Officers learned that Sean and Portia had been arguing that night. He had taken her phone charger and her apartment key without permission. While Sean stayed overnight occasionally, he lived elsewhere. Portia was the only person listed on the lease. Detectives believed Sean used that key to enter the apartment. They also questioned the missing surveillance footage from the front door camera, a camera that worked but didn't capture the incident. Investigators believe Sean deleted the footage. Text messages revealed mounting motives. Portia was seeing someone else. She was refusing to give Sean full custody of the children. And she was financially stable while he was struggling. Surveillance footage showing Sean and Garman driving near the apartment on the morning of the murder suggested Sean may have been showing Garman where Portia lived. And the distinct jacket seen on surveillance, the Ferrari coat, was later matched to photos on Garman's social media. Finally, when investigators subpoenaed phone records, they learned Sean and Garman had communicated approximately 18 times in the hours leading up to Portia's death. At that point, detectives believed the evidence showed Sean had enlisted Garman to kill Portia and stage the scene as a home invasion. And after more than a year of piecing together timelines, footage, and records, they were finally ready to act. It took 15 months to get here. On April 3rd, 2025, Sean Landis Range Jr., 32, was taken into custody in connection with Portia's death. By that point, the man investigators believed helped carry out the killing was already behind bars. Benjamin Garman, 26, had been in custody out of county on federal weapons charges. By the time arrests were made, investigators believed they could establish both motive and participation. Both men were charged with first-degree murder. According to arrest reports, investigators believe Garman acted at Sean's direction. To this day, both men deny responsibility. Sean denies knowing Garman, and Garman denies shooting Portia or acting as a home invader. There are a lot of things that make this case disturbing, but not because it was chaotic and not because it was impulsive. What makes it disturbing is how confident Sean and Garmin were. They didn't stumble into this. It was clear. They made a plan, not a thoughtful one, not a defensible one, but a plan nonetheless. They didn't think they were being reckless. They didn't think they were being careless. And they certainly didn't think they were going to get caught. So they carried out their plan in broad daylight, on a Saturday morning, a time when people are home, when cameras are recording, not because something is wrong, but because they're always on. Daylight doesn't hide anything. It illuminates it. And yet the story that followed, the one Sean told, depended on ignoring all of that, that they wouldn't be seen. But they were. Cameras inside the apartment complex captured movement that morning. They captured Sean, and they captured the man with him. And it didn't stop there. Benjamin Garmin, the man seen on surveillance, was later found wearing that same distinctive jacket on his own social media, the same one seen during the murder, in plain sight. And in the hours after the shooting, their brazenness didn't fade. It escalated. That night, Sean and Garmin were captured again. This time, at the home of Damian Range. A Ring camera recorded Sean boasting about killing people. "We up the murder rate," he said. Garmin was later seen online boasting about being a jack boy. All of it recorded. All of it time-stamped. All of it happening in plain sight. They were smarter than everyone else. That's the lie they told themselves. Not just about when the violence happened, but about how invisible they thought it would be. And daylight kept proving them wrong. Part of Sean's account positioned him as the hero, the protector. He said he was there to check on his family. He said he was injured trying to shield the children. He said he chased an armed man and wrestled stolen phones back, all while he himself was unarmed. He wrestled a man who had just shot him. The pieces didn't fit. And underneath that story was a very different reality. At the same time, he claimed to be protecting his family. He was fighting Portia, fighting over money, fighting over control, and ultimately, fighting for custody of the children. That matters, because fighting for custody implies you believe you are the parent best suited to raise them, that you represent what's best for their lives. Pause. But how does the parent who thought he was the one best suited to raise the kids become the very person responsible for what unfolded on the morning of January 13, 2024, placing those same children inside one of the most traumatic situations imaginable? Investigators say that after the initial intrusion, Sean left the children alone in the apartment with their mother dying or already dead. And when he realized that his story wouldn't hold, that Portia was shot multiple times by a gunman who somehow never managed to land a shot on him, despite Sean placing himself in front of the kids as a target. Investigators say he called Garmin back to the apartment to shoot him in the arm, not out of chaos, but to make his account appear more believable. But beyond every violation, every reckless choice, and every layer of trauma inflicted that morning, by the end of it, those children had lost not one parent, but both. One to death, the other to the choices he made. Nothing about that morning served the best interests of those children. Not the planning, not the delay, not the story that came afterward. And that's where the irony becomes impossible to ignore. If this wasn't about protecting them, if it wasn't about their well-being or their best interests, then what was it all for? And while the courts will determine what happened inside that apartment, there are already questions about timelines, responsibility, and what evidence reveals, and what it doesn't. If you want more cases like this, stories that dig deeper, that explore the context behind the crime, and how investigations continue long after the headlines fade, don't forget to follow the Sleuthy Stories podcast. I'll see you in the next one. Until next time, stay safe out there. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.